This presentation is going to be in English, and it's my great pleasure to invite Johannes Schindelin from Germany, one of the, I don't know if key developers, but I would say one of the contributors of QEMU project. QEMU is the pronunciation.
I don't know how they pronounce it. I pronounce it QEMU.
QEMU. So, okay, let's call it QEMU. And Johannes is going to talk about what QEMU is, what features does it have, and because he didn't know too much about what would be the audience here, so just feel free to interrupt him whenever you want and ask the questions about QEMU. We will see whether QEMU is an alternative to Xen or competition of Xen, whatever. Please.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the opportunity to speak here in Prague. I had the pleasure to spend some nights already here. It's beautiful. Okay, so now to QEMU. A little bit to the history of QEMU. It was originally invented, started as a proof of concept. Fabrice Bayard, he's a Frenchman, he had this lovely idea how to accelerate emulation of CPUs. That is, to emulate a program which is written for a different CPU on, say, a PowerPC. He tried to do this first only for programs. So it's no system emulation, it's no virtualization, it's just you have a program which is, say, for Linux IE86, and it should run on Linux PowerPC. That's very much what Frank earlier today told you about Rosetta. It's a syscall, so the syscalls stay the same, it's only the CPU which is virtualized. This was done short before 2003, and eventually he succeeded and posted it to a Linux kernel mailing list. That's why why QEMU is so connected to Linux, because it all started with Linux. Of course, Solaris is becoming a big, big subject with QEMU. He started then to also have some virtual devices, in a sense, making something akin to VMware, which is a virtualization, you know what I mean, a VM, which just virtualizes devices, but executes on the same CPU as the system was written for. But QEMU did not actually do that part, the run code natively, but it emulated as it was concepted for single programs, CPU on another CPU. So the biggest part about it is dynamic translation. So this will be a major part of this talk, so that you understand the main ideas behind QEMU. From these ideas, you also see how some decisions, some design decisions were done, and why they are not more like Xen. Then another slide is about KQEMU. This is the acceleration. This is actually where virtualization comes in. This allows to execute code natively as far as possible, as long as no I/O happens, as long as no virtual device is accessed. After that, I will tell you something about the networking inside QEMU, and at the end, I will talk about block devices, because after all, you want to access data, you want to change data with the emulated system. So, as I said, in 2003, it was started by Fabrice Bayard. He's not the only key developer. Paul Brook joined in 2006, I think in February, and now the two of them have committer permissions, but there are many, many, many contributors. Some only contributed some documentation, some only some small patches, and some are more regular on the list and even help users, because there's only a devil list and no user mailing list. Also, as I just said, it was initially concepted strictly as a syscall on another CPU emulator. And this translation was extended to emulate some CPUs like, for example, Intel as a test case, because it's good to test emulation on the same processor as it is conceived to emulate. but you can also emulate Spark processors, MIPS processors, ARM. There are experimental patches for Motorola 68000. And, well, basically you can just take the code, it's open source, and write your own CPU emulation. It was also, there's a new feature, which is still kind of experimental, to emulate multiprocessor systems. Of course, to emulate this correctly, you have to keep the timing somehow virtual, so that you can execute a piece of code, then turn back the time and execute another piece of code on the virtual other CPU. So this is relatively new and not as tested as the other code, but it's nevertheless very interesting if you have to test systems, programs for systems which you do not own yourself. You also can use QEMU to test if a device that you want to build works nice with a driver for a system which you do not yet have, because in QEMU, of course, you can slow down the time, you can inspect at any time the registers, the I/O registers, memory mappings, memory contents. This makes debugging very easy. Okay, now on to dynamic translation. Probably you know the concept of JIT, just-in-time translation. So this is the concept of translation, that you take functions, so small functions, which are the implementation of the opcode for another CPU. So say you want to emulate Pentium on a PowerPC. So you have an opcode which loads say an immediate number into a register. So you write a small function which has the same functionality in C. You let it translate into machine code for PowerPC, and if you have that, you can now take all code for the Pentium, translate that into the small code snippets generated for PowerPC, chain them and execute them. For the first execution, this is not very fast because you have to actually do more work than if you just emulate it. But for every subsequent execution, you can take just this chained code snippet string and execute it all over again. Of course, then it will get much, much faster. That was the idea that Fabrice wanted to try out, and it worked very, very well. So as an example, you see here a very simple function. It's to add two numbers and to return the result. And you see on the right-hand side a Pentium code for it. So actually it's i86. This should even work on 386 if somebody still has such hardware. Actually, it's not really true. If you take, for example, GCC and let it generate code for this function, it will have more instructions for whatever reasons. Because most of you probably know that hardware is a black art. So it's kind of magic, because you don't really execute one instruction after the other. There are pipelines, and depending on the model of Pentium, one or the other order of instructions is faster or slower. I only try to make it very easy here so that you get the concept that I want to show you, to illustrate you. You have a function which is translated by the C compiler. This is important that you let it compile by a C compiler, because then you only have to write the C code for the target instruction set. And you just get the instructions for your host. So the target is what you want to emulate, and the host is the computer on which you actually run the whole emulation. So if you now compile, say, an opcode, and you get here the code, of course, the RET instruction, the return, this has to be cut off. This is not only as easy as it seems. You will see in the next slide that there are hard cases, and this is in fact, a very big problem at the moment for QEMU, because you cannot easily compile it with the fourth generation of GCC. But let's look at first at the bullet points here. Porting to a new host is relatively easy because you take the same C code that you translated into the host code, and you only have to make minor corrections for different kinds of hosts because you treat all these code snippets equally. You cut off the red, and you have to adjust the code a little bit. The optimization is done largely by the compiler, so you don't have to do much work for optimizing the code once it is translated, in the hope that the C compiler will do a good job. Also, using C with the very close connection to assembler, you can use host registers in order to speed up all these oplets, these code snippets. Okay, on to a more complicated example. If you want to implement the sine functions, which basically returns plus 1, 0, or minus 1, depending on the sign of the input, then this is a relatively short implementation. And this is a little bit obscure because optimized assembler version. If you would write it in the EVE assembler, you would have three return instructions. So there is no way to just cut off the return instruction from the code snippet, which means, in turn, that you cannot just chain these oplets one after another. Because if you would do that, at some stage you would hit a return, which is wrong in that case, because you want to continue with the next snippet. This gives rise to a close dependency to the C compiler, because you have to force the C compiler to actually generate only one return instruction. And even if it would be faster in the regular case to have several exits of a function to just jump to this one return instruction. Do you see what is down there? Or? Okay, I read it to you. It depends on host compiler, is what I just said. Okay, another thing you have to pay attention to is the delayed branch slot. If you have a RISC processor, often because of those pipelines, you have a branch, it jumps somewhere else, but actually the next instruction is already executed because of the pipelining. You have to pay attention to do that correctly. So it means if you have a RET, which is a branch instruction after all, and RISC normally you say is a jump to the link register or whatever register it is in that case, you have to put a NOP behind that. So not behind it, but in place of this red, because you don't know if the next instruction would be you don't know if... I think I say rubbish here, but... It's okay? It's okay. So in one case where I tried to port QEMU to a MIPS host, I had problems with the delayed branch execution slot. That's why I wrote this down. Okay. Another thing is, of course, if you want to load something into a register, which is just a number, it is easy. You take the number, you put it into the register. But if you now have the code snippet for it, there is a special number. There is one number. And of course, when you just chain these code snippets after each other, you have to correct this value to the one that you actually want. Say you wrote the oplet implementing the loading into a register for the constant zero. And now you see in the code which is translated that in this register should be the value 17. Then you chain this code snippet and you replace the zero by a 17. You don't need a code snippet for every constant. Now, how to find out where in the host assembler code, in the snippet that was translated, where this constant actually is? This is done by using placeholders And these placeholders are then found in the relocatable ELF object. This is the DinGen compiler. So actually, before compiling QEMU, you compile a dynamic generator, which is then used to link in all these snippets, these code snippets, and to be able to fix up constants or addresses which have to be changed. Is that relatively clear, or should I just write it down with chalk? Okay, I think I take. We have a blackboard here, so I take it. So let's say you emulate loading an immediate value into EAX. That would be something like this. And because the return instruction is cut off, this is the whole code snippet for that operation. Now, if you use here a placeholder, which is special, like zero in this case, then the DinGen compiler will actually store with that code snippet the exact position of this argument, of this parameter. And when it's linked, you not only have this as assembler code, but you have also this address. Now, when the code is chained, and say you translate some instruction like load $17 into EAX, then QEMU will take that assembler code as is, and after the fact, after chaining all these, it will use this address to put this immediate parameter into it, so that actually after it works as expected. This has to be done, but it's not very, very slow either. Okay. Relocations, I call them relocations because they're called that in ELF code. Evidently, QEMU not only can be used on a host system with ELF code, but also on Windows with COFF, or on Mac OS X where it's Mac something. So different kinds of relocatable objects, and they are analyzed, and the addresses to adjust the parameters are stored together with the code snippets, with the assembler code snippets. Now, when you execute such a chain, of course, you have to stop somewhere. And you have to stop at a jump instruction, for example, because you cannot just wildly jump around in the code. But you have to fix up things after that. And especially the address is no longer correct. There's no way to fix that up easily. So the translation is in code blocks and translation blocks, so-called TBs, and they end either at the maximum number of instructions or at a jump instruction or at some exception instruction like syscall, because then something special has to happen. These translated blocks are saved in a cache, in a last recently used cache, so that you actually can execute huge programs and you don't fill up your whole memory just by translating the whole program. Also, unused code is never translated. It's also a performance question. After such a translation block, interrupts and exceptions are handled. Interrupts are special because you also have the possibility to have a timer. So with the C function set I timer, with signaling every so many microseconds, the execution is stopped and the interrupts are handled. There's an important optimization because the first versions of QEMU, they were faster than Box, for example, because nothing was emulated, but they were still not that fast. And what Fabrice finally found out is that the flags, for example, if you add something together, then a flag is set if the result is zero, or a flag is set if the result overflows the available bit size. So if you have a negative result in spite of adding two positives. And these flags, of course, for a perfect emulation, have to be calculated at each such instruction. But often they are not used. So actually what this chaining does also is to record for each translated code snippet if there's a flag which would be possibly calculated there, or if there's a flag which is used by this translated instruction. So in a second pass, you can calculate which flags actually have to be calculated and which you can just drop down to the floor. So this is a two-pass compiling step, which is an optimization. In reality, it was a substantial improvement in performance. To make this easier, assembly instructions are actually cut into smaller oplets, much like atoms are cut into quarks, maybe. And some of these oplets are only there as placeholders to know what flags have to be calculated, and some are actually oplets which have their own code snippet, which is chained in that space. Okay, this is how it looks like if you finally have something running. Actually, I have it running on a Linux system, as you can see down there. Okay, you only see it's KDE. And you see here in the window, Windows ME. Windows ME was chosen on purpose because it's the most unstable Windows version there is. So if you have to test programs for such an unstable version, you are likely to be unhappy if you have to install it on a real machine because it will crash all the time. Now, you can start this and you can save this as a snapshot, so that you don't have to wait the whole boot process, but you just load memory and device states and continue execution at a certain state. But that also means that, for example, if you do web development and have to test different web browsers, you just have your saved states with a web browser, and you always have the exactly same state to start with. So you have really reproducible execution and test processes. One word to the 1029. This was, in fact, today, early this morning, when Frank talked. I wanted to turn a movie, but the program that I wanted to use to turn the movie is based on FFmpeg, and I somehow made an error. So I could have shown you the movie, but it was very fast. It did not really wait all the time, but it was compressing all what I did into half a second. You would not really have been happy, I think. So this is just a snapshot. On to KQEMU. KQEMU is a curl module. It's originally for Linux curl, but it has been successfully installed into FreeBSD. I have been told even in Solaris with some tricks. I don't know these tricks, but I want to learn them. And there is also support for Windows NT and up. In Windows NT and up, it does not work as a kernel module because there is no kernel module, but it's a service. KQEMU itself is closed source because Fabrice Béard decided at one time that actually he wanted to have something of all these efforts he does and all the time he spends, and he even got some corporate backing, but he wanted to have even more corporate backing. So if you know somebody who wants to sponsor the open sourcing of KQEMU, go ahead, fabrice@beyard.org. How does this kernel module actually work? this kernel module is the means of executing code natively, because with kernel support, with privileged instruction support, you can actually remap memory. So if you load a program somewhere in your memory with malloc and then reading it in, or even with memmap, it's likely not to be at the position that the system, the emulated system, wants it to be. So then you can use the virtualization as this protected mode functionality of Pentium and all the other modern processors to actually map these into the correct place so that you can execute them in place natively and they actually have the correct addresses. Also, the I/O faulting and what is in this handling code of the fault is, of course, to fix it up somehow and to pretend to the program that it actually succeeded. This is only possible with this kernel module. You cannot do that in user mode. For the same reasons, this does not really work with DOS, because in DOS, you don't have virtualized memory. You don't have an MMU. You cannot easily just turn one range of memory into another range of memory for a second or two, as long as the program runs. So DOS is still, even if you have KQEMU installed, it's still dynamically translated. That is also an advantage of QEMU, because you actually have the possibility to run code natively, but in the same emulation also call code which is dynamically translated. In order to use QEMU, you want to talk to the system that you emulate. There are two versions of network devices. One is a SLIRP. It actually is a network address translation, so a masquerading firewall viewed from the outside. It's a virtual device. Hi, Frank.
I'm sorry, I have to be early. My plane leaves at 7 and I can't afford to miss that.
Nice flight.
So, thanks a lot for the talk so far, and enjoy the rest of the evening. And definitely, whatever follows the Open Source Alliance is a good meeting. Hope to see you next time.
Bye. Okay, so virtual devices, the most important devices are network devices to talk to the system, to the emulated system. They have their own set of problems, of course. So TCP is relatively easy to emulate, but it's relatively uneasy to emulate UDP or ICMP. So these have varying levels of support. Also, you can connect QEMU instances with each other on the same computer by having virtual device, virtual LAN IPs. To do this, each QEMU instance, which is connected to that VLAN, has a socket installed. And this socket is then shared between the instances of QEMU. If you want to, you can emulate another type of car network adapter. The first emulation was of RTL8139, I guess because the one who did this code had the specification handy. But NE2K, both in ISA and PCI versions, followed. And for ARM boards, you have another type of network device which is emulated. There's another type of network device that you can use, which is more versatile because it is virtualized by your host, OS. So if you have TAP devices, you can actually also receive UDP and ICMP and broadcast messages. Even on Windows 2000, there is a possibility. I have not tested myself because I don't have Windows on my machines, but I've been told that it works beautifully. Another important thing with QEMU is that by hitting Control, Alternate, and 2, you can switch to the monitor. The monitor, with the monitor, you can control some aspects, like you can eject a virtual CD-ROM and inject another virtual CD-ROM. You can get information about the running processes. You can inquire the registers. You can basically do a lot of things. Even what you see down there, the USB add and USB del, this is a very interesting new feature. USB, you can actually emulate virtual USB devices, but it's also possible on some host operating systems to just pass through the requests to the real USB device, which then means that you have, for example, if you have a scanner or some DigiCam, which is only supported on Windows, you can actually use QEMU to sniff that traffic and to reverse engineer the protocol. You can also, what I also mentioned, the snapshot system, that you have a fixed starting point in the operating system. This is done with save VM and load VM. Load VM can also be passed on the command line, so you don't have to start QEMU and go to the monitor and type in all the things. I would have liked to show you, but my computer is not connectable to this beamer because I forgot the adapter. I'm sorry, but whoever is interested in that, we can easily start that up later and play around. Now for my pet, it's the block devices. So in order to work with an emulated system, be it that you want to test something on another operating system, or be it that you have a program which is only for an obsolete operating system, and where you want to take the result and do something else with it, you have to save data. The original way is to just have a big file, raw file, which is the image of a whole hard disk. Not even a partition, it's the whole hard disk. Of course, QEMU was not the first to invent that, but Box and VMware and Virtual PC have all their own file formats for exactly this purpose, and so a block layer was introduced by which you can also access these devices. So if you have a VMware image, you just plug it into QEMU and you continue to work on it. There are also other things, what is more of the things that I did with QEMU. It's, for example, the Knoppix CD, the live CD, one of the first famous live CDs. It uses a C-loop file system, which makes it possible to squash 1.7 gigabytes of data onto one single CD because it's all packed. But it's packed in a way that you actually can extract very fast and easily single sectors. This file format is natively supported by QEMU. Also, the DMG files, which you know probably from Mac OS X, it's a proprietary format. Some think it's akin to zip files, but it's not. It's a compressed hard disk, and you can read those with QEMU. You also can emulate FAT, FAT partitions, and not only partitions, but also a virtual hard disk with just one virtual partition, which is constructed from an existing directory on your host system. Experimental write support, this does not always work as you want it. For example, in Plan 9, I've been told that successfully dies. There are other features which made QEMU very interesting, and essentially it's open source. You are free to experiment with it, you are free to extend it, and if you like it and want to contribute back, you can just send it to QEMU list and most of these contributions are really integrated into the upstream, and people are very happy with that. So there is a VNC server integrated into QEMU. That means that you can start QEMU and you don't see anything at first, but you can connect to that with a VNC viewer. This is very, very good if you have a server which runs somewhere in the world and you want to run a long running task on it. And from time to time, you just look, how far is it? Okay, it's still not crashed, wonderful, perfect. And then you close your VNC viewer again and it continues to run. And what's even better, the all the performance, which is normally eaten by these interactive things like graphical display, it's now obsolete. It's now it doesn't affect the execution. Like I said, USB devices, physical ones, you can access them. There is also the possibility to emulate a tablet. This is important because, as you know, if you move a mouse, it's not translated one-to-one into mouse movements, but it's the faster you move, the even faster the mouse pointer moves. So this is the reason why you must choose, usually, between the host mouse pointer or the guest mouse pointer. So this takes some getting used to, unless you take the emulated tablet device, which of course takes absolute coordinates and is precise. Also, like I mentioned, SMP machines, sound support, some other things that are so obscure that I don't dare to explain them here. Basically, that's it with this nice picture of Bell Linux, which not yet boots. Thank you very much.
Are there any questions?
I have one question. How does it works? QEMU starts and it starts in a virtual address space, and it loads into that address space the devices and BIOS and everything it needs to start the emulation. And it translates the code.
Yes.
And everything is still in this one address space?
So there's this system emulation, and yes, everything in there is emulated at first. So if you have the KQEMU module, then some of the code is natively executed, but the BIOS and all the devices at first are really emulated. They are in that program running on your desktop.
Simplicity, if we don't use KQEMU, what are our limits if we are on a 32-bit machine, we have only 4 giga for the address space?
It really depends on the host system.
The experience of Windows, for example, the older XP, no, not XP, but until XP, you had basically just 1.7 gigabyte, which you could really use, even if you had 4 gigabyte installed. There are modes in XP that, or maybe it's standard now, that you can use up to 3 gigabyte for user mode programs. Basically, that's, I think, the best that you can do with 32-bit host systems at the moment, that you can get 3 gigabyte of 4 that you can address. So these 3 gigabyte have to be shared, of course, with some libraries, but basically you come very close to using 3 gigabyte for that emulated system.
Do you replace the code which was translated, or do you still keep the original instructions, or?
I don't know if you can change the size of the cache, but whenever this cache is full, I think it's completely emptied and all the translated snippets fill the cache again. So you don't keep code indefinitely. If you have too much code which was translated, then you throw away all translated code.
Okay, thank you.
I have one question. Since QEMU is an open source project, how many people are kind of actively working on the code? Because it seems that the kernel accelerator, KQEMU, is a work of one French gentleman, if I understood it correctly.
KQEMU is the pet child of Fabrice Béard. It's closed source, so he is evidently the only one working on it. It's not completely true, because Paul Brook, before he joined Fabrice as principal maintainer, he had a competing product, which is QVM86. It's a little bit modeled after Plex 86, which was a very old competing product to Box. But of course, when he joined Fabrice, he didn't want to annoy him, so he dropped that on the floor. But it's still available, and if people are interested, I bet they can shape this up so that it works. And this is open source. As for QEMU, regular contributors, I would say about 5 to 10, and occasional contributors up to 30, something like that. That's the volume of the project. Yes.
Or the snapshotting feature. How does the snapshot feature relate to the disk image and disk structure?
Yes, this is something. So if you save a virtual machine, so a snapshot, you should also save the image, the hard disk image. Because if you don't, if you just start anew, for example, with that image after saving it and quitting, then it's corrupt. So it has to check again. But this is not really... QEMU doesn't help you there. You have to... yes, exactly.
Makes sense. Huh? Okay. What other questions do we have?
Is there any way to turn QEMU into not dynamic translation mode for testing, when you just implement a new target architecture and you the dynamic cutting the return instructions isn't working yet?
Okay, there is a patch by some Russian guy, I think, with which you can interpret the instructions. So this is more like Box. It's as slow as Box, but it's more accurate, evidently, because even the timing is really correct. And there's also no blue pill exit as with other virtual machines, because every aspect is really correctly emulated there. But this only exists, as far as I know, for the i86 target. So, for example, MIPS or ARM or Spark code is not interpretable by this patch. For this, you can single step. Single stepping means that you basically stop each translation block at one instruction which is translated and then directly jump to. This is also very much slower than non-single stepping mode, but it's more, yeah, it works with every emulated CPU in QEMU.
Other questions? Seems there are none. So, thanks again for your presentation. Johannes is staying here if you want to just catch him up.